dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bass to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse. This is Unwelcome Guests. My name's Len Gary. Before we get into today's program, we'd like to apologize to those of you WEOS listeners for the technical difficulties with last week's forum on the Rockefeller drug laws. As this is too important an issue to just let slide, we're planning to rebroadcast the panel on the Rockefeller drug laws in its entirety 2 weeks from now, along with a new interview we've just received also on the subject of the drug war. However, if you have a computer equipped to download MP3 files, you can hear the part you missed right away by visiting our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. That's the word radio, the numeral 4, the word all. This week, we're going to focus on the issues of media democracy raised by the protests late last month at the National Association of Broadcasters Convention in San Francisco. Protesters associated with the Movement for Media Democracy and Low-Power Community Radio set up a counter-convention that included street protests. The media democracy movement focuses on the control and ownership of the media and its role in a democratic society. Whoever controls the media has the power to shape what we think about and how we think about it by putting certain ideas forward as well as refusing to allow certain issues and viewpoints to reach the public. What exists is a system of private sector-based censorship by corporate interests, which actually hides behind the First Amendment to protect their monopoly on acceptable discourse. Is this ideological censorship deliberate? You bet. Tonight we're going to feature highlights from a forum on media and labor, where you will hear evidence of deliberate censorship of working people's issues. In our second hour, we're going to examine the NAB's rise to power and hear an interview with Mbana Kantako, whose unlicensed station was raided and shut down at gunpoint on September 30th, after 12 years on the air serving Springfield, Illinois' impoverished black community. First, here's some highlights of the protests against the NAB and the media monopoly from the streets of San Francisco, the week of September 20th through 23rd. There are now people trying to get into the Moscone Center, banging on the doors. Okay, so there are now about 50 people piled up in front of the front doors of the NAB conference. You can hear people yelling in the background. There's a line of police and men in suits. There are some people inside. What happened?
Well, the NAB was having a private meeting with the FCC, one of the FCC commissioners, and so I got into the meeting, and Eddie Fritz came up on the stage and introduced the FCC commissioner, and just as he was about to get onto the stage, I ran up onto the stage and grabbed the microphone, and I said, I'm here on behalf of the free speech protesters, and we're saying that the airways belong to the public, they're not for corporate profit, and I started talking about micro radio, and the security guy grabbed me and covered my mouth. And I kept yelling about low-power radio, and he kept his hand over my mouth. And I was yelling, this is free speech? And he dragged me out of the room, and then he told me, if you're not quiet, you better be quieter, you might get hurt. So I shut up. And they dragged somebody else out, too, who started yelling in the room. And Now we're outside the building, and now there are people locked down inside.
Well, that was the latest from Andrea Buffa, Executive Director of Media Alliance, one of the local sponsors and organizers of this free speech event, this Speak Out Against the National Association of Broadcasters.
What's your name?
Tim Harrington.
And you work here at the convention center?
Yeah.
What is your opinion about what's going on today? What do you see?
Oh, wow. I see a bunch of kids just doing their thing, I guess. Mm-hmm. You know.
And given what they're saying and what you're hearing, what is their thing?
The thing is through their own airwave, I guess. You know, they want to hear their own stuff, I guess. You know.
Mm-hmm.
I guess they don't want this corporate bullshit going on.
Corporate bullshit. Can you elaborate on that? Why do you think it's corporate bullshit?
I'm just going with what they're saying.
Uh-huh.
You know, so.
What do you think?
I don't know. I really don't know.
Let me ask you this. You're a working man. You work here at the Moscone Center, I guess, in a restaurant or something, right?
Yeah,
Okay. When you listen to the media, to the news, to all of that, do you hear things that reflect your reality as a working person, not a dot-com millionaire, that reflect your concerns?
All the time, yeah.
You do?
Yeah, I do. There's never no good news. It's always bad news. You know what I mean? So it's...
If you could program a radio station, what kind of things do you think would be important to have on it? What would be useful to you as a person? What kind of discussions about news and other things that are going on in the society would you want to hear?
I want to hear stuff about the homeless, you know, stuff like that, you know what I mean? Instead of, commercializing stuff, I wouldn't have that, you know. It'd be more to help the people than to hurt them.
How many paychecks away are you from being homeless?
I live paycheck to paycheck, so this is the way it is around here in the United States.
Most of your friends, people you know, in the same position?
Same position, yeah.
Is that a reality that you see reflected on television or on the radio, that this is how people live?
Yeah, that's how it is. It's the way that people live. It's the way they want us to live. You know, it's just the way the government is, I think.
Can we talk a little bit about the upcoming elections and stuff? What do you think about the way that's being covered on TV and on the radio by the things that are all owned by these people inside the building?
I don't think it's right. I really don't. I think the elections, it's supposed to be free, but it doesn't seem to be free. It seems like everybody's getting paid off somewhere. Everybody but us, you know, poor people. That's how I feel.
Have you considered voting for Nader?
No, but I'll think about it.
Have you heard anything about what Nader's ideas and platforms and, you know, as a presidential campaigner are on the media? Have you heard about, you know, what he stands for and what he wants to do?
No, I haven't heard not a word about him or anything like that.
So, you might not even know that there was anyone but Gorin Bush that was even running for the presidency.
Exactly, huh. Exactly. Yeah, that ain't right. It ain't right. Everybody should know who's running. Should be posted up on the things, you know, should be allowed to do their thing, you know.
Have you ever heard of the Telecommunications Act of 1996?
No, ma'am.
Okay, well, now, let me tell you what it is, and then I'll ask you what you think about that. In 1996, there used to be laws that would limit the amount of radio stations that any corporation could own in a given city, in a given place. That wiped those out. So now you have these things like Clear Channel, that have over 1,000 radio stations that they, you know, program remotely, and they like this because then they can sell mass advertising. We can put your ad on 1,000 stations, advertise with us. This was something that was done. The public airwaves were given over to these people. They said they can have as much, you can have buy as much as you want. And so now our radio stations are going for hundreds of millions of dollars just to buy one in San Francisco here. Now, I guess my question is, how do you feel as a person, since these are supposed to be our airwaves as citizens, that you never even knew that this was happening? You didn't even know that your representative voted for this, because most of them did, Democrats and Republicans.
That ain't cool at all, man. Really, they hide so much stuff for us, to the people, you know, that they just hide it. They like to push things into the back door without telling nobody nothing. I don't think it's right.
Yeah.
Is there anything else you want to say?
I hope these guys keep it up all day long.
Shut down NAB! Shut down NAB! Shut down NAB! I'm speaking with Luke Hagen, who is the lawyer who has been most identified with the success and the struggles of Micro Power Radio. We're down here actually taping this at the protest in the Union Square. And how do you feel about this protest against National Association of Broadcasters? What do you think the significance of all this is?
I think it's wonderful. I think for the first time, the National Association of Broadcasters has been outed. You know, that they'll never be anonymous again. They'll never be this secret society. They're not going to be able to do their dirty work behind the scenes without people recognizing who they are and what they're doing. And, you know, the corporations that they front for, you know, Westinghouse and General Electric, these defense industries that own ABC and NBC and CBS and who never get questioned because they own the very media that would question them, they just lost their hiding place. And to me, it's wonderful. I don't know where they're going to go to or what front they're going to establish, but they'll never be able to do this behind the scenes again.
I should say Luke has a big smile on his face. What role do you think the micro-powered radio movement has played in this?
It was major. It was major. I mean, one of the reasons that the NAB has been, in fact, uncovered by all of this is because they were put in a position of having to openly confront the FCC. I mean, for the last 25 years, or actually since 1930s, the FCC and the NAB have been this revolving door. You know, it's like the Pentagon and the defense industry. The generals go and work for the contractors and vice versa. And the FCC, you know, even the current chair, Kennard, who's been doing a wonderful thing around the micro radio, he's an ex-NAB attorney. And all of these guys have always been on the same side. And around the micro radio movement, there was a split. The FCC had to acknowledge after the Telecommunications Act of 96 that there had become such monopolization in the industry that it was just shameful. And they had to do something about it. And the NAB is such a greedy bunch of us. They just wouldn't even give up anything to them. And that created this fight that's going on. And, you know, the NAB is going to lose it, right? The American people have now heard what real democratic media can sound like, and I don't think they're going to go back on it.
Why do you think the FCC, let me put it this way, were you surprised when the FCC actually came out with this ruling that was going to license low-power radio, at least those that had not ironically broken the law?
On some level, you know, they've done almost everything they could to marginalize it by making third adjacent channels the only ones that can establish micro radio. That really excludes enormous numbers of voices that could legitimately be heard. And by setting up a series of obstacles, they've tried to marginalize it. But on the other hand, the FCC during its hearings acknowledged that there were 25,000 calls they got last year alone on micro radio. And they acknowledged that there were over 1,000 stations that went on the air that they had no control over. And while they bragged about having shut down 300 or 400, what they didn't mention is those people were back on the air within a matter of days. So that they were confronted with the kind of civil disobedience that was beyond their control. So on some level, it wasn't just out of the goodness of their hearts. I mean, Kennard and Powell are African Americans. They are outraged that there's less than 1% of radio ownership by African Americans. California is over 50% non-white right now, and yet the ownership of media by non-white people is less than 3% in the entire state and country. And at some point, the FCC is going to have to bite the bullet on this. And so I think that's what they were confronted with. They didn't have a whole lot of choices, you understand? I mean, at some point, it's going to get taken away from them if they won't acknowledge the rights of people to communicate with each other without going through these billionaire corporations.
You could say then that, in a sense, it's been a grassroots or grass radio struggle that's really brought this thing to the fore without, let's say, the work of, let's say, starting with Stephen Dunifer and then the spread of micro radio, this really wouldn't have happened. We probably wouldn't be here today.
Absolutely. I mean, it's like saying that the civil rights movement was a gift from the Kennedys and the Johnsons. I mean, that's nonsense. They were responding to uprisings in the streets. They were responding to mass mass resistance to an unworkable system. And I think that the kind of reaction that you saw in Seattle around the WTO and these globalized corporations that are destroying unions and destroying minimum wage and really engaging in this wholesale attack on the people of the world, they can't do it without being identified anymore. I mean, the great work that's been done around globalization and the WTO and the IMF, I mean, these guys can't meet anywhere anymore. They couldn't meet in LA, they couldn't meet in Philadelphia, they can't meet in Seattle. In Prague, they're closing the borders right now. I mean, the idea that Havel, who's a liberal, has got to close the borders to stop demonstrations against these fascists, you know, is just incredible. It's wonderful. I think it's...
I know you've retired now, Lou. How long were you in practice?
Oh, I've been practicing for 30 years.
And how do you rate this case among all the cases you've had? I mean, the case is not just the case, but your case for Stephen Dunham, for your fight for Micropower Radio. How would you rate this in your career in terms of the pleasure it's given you? Where would you put it?
Oh, I think this is one of the most enjoyable and powerful issues I've ever worked on. When you hear the voices of the thousands of people who set up these stations, there's nothing like it. I mean, there are stations like Radio Watson in Watsonville that speaks to a Chicano community that's never had its own voice. In Seattle, there was a station for a Korean community that's 100,000 people, 50,000 of whom don't speak English, and the only station they had was a Los Angeles Korean station. KIND in San Marcos. There were just these wonderful community stations all over the nation, each of which had hundreds of people speaking over the stations and having shows. Kids and women and old people and disabled and minority community, people who'd never been able to speak with their own voice, who'd always had to go when they were invited onto KPFA or NPR or somebody else's station. Here they had their own voice, and it's so powerful and so exciting. You know, the solutions to the problems we face are not going to be given by Gore and Bush and the people with the millions of dollars that own these stations. And the only way to find out what those solutions are going to be is to listen to the people who have them. And that's what micro radio provides. That's what community radio gives that no other station can ever give. And it's just been exciting to watch it and hear it and listen to it, the plurality of voices. I can't tell you how exciting it is.
I don't think we can say anything more about it. Thanks very much, Luke, for being with us at San Francisco Liberation Radio.
All right.
I want to welcome you, brothers and sisters. My name is Steve Zeltzer. I'm with the Labor Video Project and with the Union Producers and Programmers Network and the Labor Action Committee on the National Association of Broadcasters. San Francisco has a long tradition of labor struggle and labor history. And there was a general strike in 1934 led by the longshoremen that led really to the unionization of San Francisco. As a result of that, San Francisco is one of the strongest unionized cities in the United States. And one of the things that made San Francisco a powerful union town is the voice of workers, having a voice and having union newspapers. Our first speaker tonight was actually the first labor television reporter in San Francisco. And his name is Dick Meister. He writes a column in the San Francisco Examiner. He's an independent journalist. And he had an experience as a labor television reporter in San Francisco. And he wants to tell you about that experience at KQED. Welcome, Dick Meister.
Yeah, I have to say that standing here, I'm the first, last, and only labor reporter who ever covered on television. There's no doubt about that. I reported daily on television on labor on KQED, and that's not done. Of course, it hadn't been done before, and it's not been done since. Certainly not on commercial television or on PBS, which is where I reported. It's not done on commercial radio either. I think it's done on some non-commercial radio stations, but not very many of them either. Labor is just not covered by the broadcast media. I think before I get into that, let me explain to you why I got into was able to do that, was able to cover labor on television. Actually, my experience as being the first labor reporter on television and the last both stemmed from strikes. The first one was the San Francisco newspaper strike of 1968. This shut down the Examiner and the Chronicle for about 2 months. So the people at KQED got together with the Ford Foundation and said, hey, we got a great idea. Let's put on a nightly news show to replace what they're not getting because the newspapers aren't coming out. And KQED was very serious. This was going to be a serious effort. So it sounded like a great idea, so they did it. And the program became extremely popular because there were no newspapers coming out. And here was this nightly news show. The TV reporting then is as bad as it is now. You know, 20-second sound bites and that's it. But this was an in-depth show, a whole hour, stories that ran on maybe 10 or 15 minutes. You know, that was a big deal. Well, the way they did it was the hiring reporters, the striking reporters, some of the striking reporters, to do the show. What we did is, I was one of them, and I was at that point, I was the Chronicle's labor editor. Those were the good old days when the newspapers had labor editors. I had been at that point labor editor for 6 years, and that was a major job. What we did is we set up exactly the same situation as at the Chronicle every day. At the Chronicle every day, all of us specialists, me as the labor editor, another guy as the science editor, the education editor, whatever, we would sit around in the afternoon and discuss, you know, what are the big stories? What are you covering? What are the major stories? And we just, among ourselves, decide, well, this should be the major story of the day, that should be the major, the secondary story, etc. And we go out and do our stories. So we did the same thing on television, and it was just fascinating for people because they'd never seen it. That's how a newspaper is put together. You sit around and you have news conferences every day and decide these things. People, all the things that people had seen of newspapers were, you know, these funny but absolutely irrelevant comedies and romantic comedies that showed that newspapers worked this way and that way, and they didn't show how newspapers worked at all. But people had seen this. You know, it was amazing that they had never seen a newspaper put together. But in any case, it was called, the show, by the way, it was called Newspaper of the Air. The camera, we did the same thing we did every day at the Chronicle. It was no different, except that the camera was on us. And then finally, at first, of course, we were just talking to each other. And that was not exactly television. But we finally learned to use the television media, because nothing wrong with the media. It's just what's put on it. The strike went on for 2 months. And when the strike ended, the Ford Foundation moved in and said, okay, this was a great show. This is very popular. Let's do it on a permanent basis. We'll give you the money to make it a permanent show. However, with one caveat, this will be seed money. You're going to have to, eventually, we're going to take away the money. We're not going to give you any more money. You're going to have to replace it with money from the public, from the people who subscribe to KQED, which we thought was fine because it was, as I say, it was very popular, and we assumed that we'd get a lot of money and that'd be fine. Some of us who had been reporters on the show joined the new show, the permanent show. Some of us went back to the newspapers. I was one of them. I went back to the Chronicle, and I lasted 2 whole years until I got in trouble there because of my coverage of the farm labor movement, which was just beginning under Cesar Chavez at the time. What had happened was that it turns out that one of the publisher's real close buddies was one of the state's largest corporate growers, a guy named Bob DiGiorgio, and he was very, very unhappy with the fact that I was reporting so much on farm labor. Well, I was doing a lot of work on farm labor because it was just beginning, and I had the first stories on Chavez. I mean, he didn't say I was prejudiced at all. He didn't say the stories were biased one way or the other. It was just the idea that I was even doing it. You should ignore this. He called this agitator Chavez, terrible person. Because the problem was that from Giorgio's point of view, I was trying to be as straight down the middle, and I had to be. I had people breathing down my neck. I had to be fair and, you know, give both sides. But in reporting on farm labor, if you told, just objectively, describe the conditions, it was horrible. I mean, it was obviously these people were in terrible conditions. And Bob DiGiorgio could say, I could stick a microphone in front of him or my notepad in front of him and say, these people say you're mistreating them. What do you say? Oh, I'm not mistreating them at all. They're living in great conditions. Well, then I'd go out as a reporter and I'd bring a cameraman with me, and obviously they weren't. They were in terrible straits. So DiGiorgio did not want the stuff to be reported at all, obviously. And he leaned on his friend, the publisher, who in turn leaned on the editors of the Chronicle, who in turn leaned on me, and suddenly Everything, all my stories on farm labor were just chopped to pieces or not run at all. I complained. And what happened when I complained? Oh, okay. Here, I'd been doing it for 8 years, and I immodestly say I had a national reputation. I was very good. I admit it. You know, I'm not ashamed. But they leaned on, they said, you're going to cover, from now on, you're going to be on the police beat. Now, that's where you put a very beginning reporter. You know, that's really the pits. That's the worst thing you can do to somebody. You sit there, you know, you work from midnight to 8 in the morning. You don't really do anything except listen to police radio and call the city desk and say, hey, there was a murder reported on 28th Street. Go out there and do something about it. And they sent a report. You didn't even get to report it yourself. I mean, this was obviously what they were doing. I mean, it was punishment, serious. And I did what I assume they expected me to do. I said, to hell with you, and I quit. Well, immediately, the people at Newsroom contacted me. I didn't contact them. They contacted me. I didn't even have time. And they said, don't do anything until we can talk with you. Yeah, fine. I liked the show. I'd been on the show during the strike. I'd been on the show, the earlier show. We talked, and they hired me. And on the understanding that I was to cover labor. They said, we want a labor reporter. We think labor should be covered in depth, and there's nobody else around that's been doing it except you, and you're the guy we want. Fine. I'm happy to do it. They talked about, well, maybe you should also cover business, you know, the stock market and such things. I said, no, I don't understand the stock market. I don't want to understand it. I'm interested strictly in labor. Okay. And they backed off and said, that's fine. That'll do it. So I went to work there. And for the first, about 4 years, it was great. And I was able to do every night, let's mind you, every single night, 1, 2, sometimes 3 labor stories, and at good length for TV, you know, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, sometimes even longer. This is unheard of on television. And people were apparently pleased with it. I assumed they were. Things went along very well. Then we had problems. The money that was supposed to, you know, that the public was supposed to contribute to make up for when the Ford Foundation started pulling back its contributions and the public was supposed to bring it in, that wasn't coming in very fast. The directors of KQED, and as I'm sure you know, the people who run every television station in this country, including public television stations, are all corporate people. I mean, all the directors of KQED are, you know, this corporation, that corporation, this is their attitude, this is they direct it that way. Well, in any case, they decided, geez, what are we going to do? We got to get the money. We know what to do. They went out and hired a whole batch of management people from commercial television. Westinghouse Broadcasting was the company at the time. And said, okay, you guys come in here and you shape it up. Well, and these guys were your typical commercial television types. And they couldn't imagine. Covering labor? Who covers labor? You know, does NBC cover labor? Does ABC cover labor? They don't need to do that. That's ridiculous. And 10-minute stories? Are you kidding? You know, 1 minute at the max. If it's a real big story, we may go 1 minute. You know, that their whole approach was. And they brought with them, too, you know, the non-commercial commercials. This program brought to you by Mobil Oil. You know, that was not a commercial. Oh, no, not much. But, in fact, those were the best commercials that a company could possibly have. Because the elite said, oh boy, these guys are so nice. I'm going to go buy their gasoline or whatever. You know, and it was anyway. Suddenly, it was after about 4 years. Suddenly, I was told, we don't need labor coverage anymore. Yeah. Look, the news director said, we don't need labor coverage, and we don't need you to cover it. We want you to cover, you know, anything. And you see, you have to understand that the approach of Newsroom, one of the things that made it unique was that it was sort of like a commune. We all sat around and decided what should be covered. And we all were experts. We had a science writer, we had an education editor, and you know, we all had our specialties. And we decided among ourselves what should be covered more or less. And the anchor man that we had was a moderator really. He just sort of said, well, I said, God, I got this great labor story, it's worth 10 minutes tonight. Oh, don't be silly. I got an education story that's worth a half an hour, you know. It was a commune. I mean, we settled it. You know, we didn't have any problems. But suddenly, it was a dictatorship. It was to be dictated from the top down by the news director, who was very anti-labor. He made no bones about that. He didn't like the unions or anything. We were to cover things on a, like commercial television does, on a reactive basis. That is, you know, if there's a strike or something out in the open, you go out and cover it. You can't avoid it. But you don't go doing any digging. You don't listen to the labor's point of view. You just, what it is, the typical labor to this day is still, there's a picket line. So you run out with a microphone, stick it in somebody's picket's face, and the picket says, the boss is a rat. And then you run over to the boss, and the boss says, I am not a rat. You rush into the station, you put it on the air, 20 seconds, and that's a story. And that's balanced. We have both sides, you know, that's fair. That's exactly the way they do it. And they still do it. I can't believe it. I feel that I was a failure because I thought that maybe I could influence them to do something else, but I couldn't, obviously. But in any case, the news director, who had suddenly been given all this power and who became a dictator, suddenly said, we're not going to cover labor as a beat anymore. That's ridiculous. Labor is not, you know, we'll still cover education, and we'll still cover whatever else, but labor, nah, that's nothing, you know. So I was to be assigned to other things. And when there were labor stories, mind you, and there were some, the kind they couldn't avoid, like, you know, a strike or something like, some big strike or something like that, they didn't send me out to cover it. They were going to send out inexperienced, young, inexperienced reporters who didn't know what was going on and were told by the news director, who was very anti-labor, here's what you want to cover. And the stories invariably turned out anti-labor. There's no way of anybody would agree that with that if they'd seen him. Well, fortunately, that didn't work because luckily I had developed a following among the general public and within the labor movement, bless them, and there was a great protest, and when the plans had leaked out, Herb Kane ran in his column in the Chronicle, and otherwise it got leaked out, and there was great protest, and they backed off. The station said, okay, you will continue to have a labor beat, and you can continue to cover labor. And what they'd tried to do to me was to assign me, they didn't want to, mind you, they weren't trying to get rid of me necessarily. They were trying to get rid of labor coverage because they told me, oh, don't worry. And they were, I think they were sincere in this. You can cover City Hall. That's what they wanted me to do. And I said, no, because I had been a political reporter before I was a labor reporter. And I said, no, I'm not going to do that. You know, and as I say, they backed off. Well, though the beat wasn't abandoned, the news director kept harassing me like crazy. He kept assigning me to non-labor stories, which I refused to cover. I said, no, I'm too busy covering labor stories. Forget it. You know, I'm not going to do that. And he kept threatening to suspend me for doing that, for saying no. And he was going behind my back and assigning labor stories to other people, who, again, he could manipulate. And when I did stories sometimes, suddenly, somehow, they never appeared on the air. You know, I went down in the editing room, and the editor and I worked very carefully and got this story all ready to go, and never showed up on the air. Now, mind you, I wasn't the only one that was being leaned on. I have to stress that. I think I was the chief one, but I wasn't the only one. They were leaning on all of us. And, this news cooperative was no longer a news cooperative. So we were, and also there was another problem. We not only were being leaned on to change the nature of the show, to cut these stories, 10-minute stories, you know, cut them down to nothing, copy the commercial television. But we also were terribly underpaid, and we really were, because we weren't even being paid as much as the news reporters on the Examiner and the Chronicle. And immodestly, I have to say, we were considered the cream of the crop. We were the best reporters in town, and we were paid less than the people on the newspapers, one. And two, we had no fringe benefits, no fringes, none. I mean, no pension, no medical care, nothing. We didn't even have a grievance procedure. We had nothing. Believe it or not, we didn't have a union. That was our problem. So we decided, by God, it's about time. I don't know why it took us so long, but we finally decided, by God, we're going to join a union. So we had an election, and we voted for NABIT, Local 51, and demanded a contract. The management said, are you kidding? They stonewall us. You know, they just wouldn't have anything to do with us. And so finally, after a while, we had no other choice. We struck. And that was the beginning of the end of me. And that was because when we struck, that was the last straw for management. I mean, labor. We don't want labor. These guys strike us. They say dirty things about us. I was doing a daily strike bulletin, which called them all kinds of names, and they were really not happy with anybody. And so, and when we finally got down, though, to finally we forced them to negotiate a contract, we were sitting down, the bosses of KQED made their move. This was a moment for them. They demanded what people on both sides, and again, I'm sorry to sound immodest, but this is what it was called on both sides of the negotiating table, called the Meister Clause. Now, it was called the Meister Clause because they knew that from past performance, I and my supporters would resist any attempt to abandon labor coverage. We wouldn't stand for it. Well, and they'd be up in for a big fight. So what they did is they went after this contract clause, which said, in effect, that management could decide the format of the program solely, alone. No reporters could have no input. So if they decided they didn't want a certain thing on the show, or they wanted to change, they wanted to make it into a sports show instead of a news show, they could do it. The reporters had no input whatsoever, would have no input. Well, everybody knew what they were after. That's why it was called the Meister Clause. What they were trying to do was to give themselves the right to abandon labor, to say, we're not going to cover labor anymore. And there was nothing I could do if they had passed this clause, this contract with this clause in it. Well, unfortunately, my fellow reporters ratified the contract. 7-1. I was the one, no vote, of course. And, you know, I don't know what to say about that, because they'd been on strike for 4.5 months. It was pretty rough. They didn't have a lot of money. And besides, I have to say, too, that they didn't have anything to lose. Nobody was threatening to stop covering education or any of the other beats they had, but only my beat. But okay, in any case, there were lots of protests from unions and from the general public about that, but this time KQED stood its ground. And that was the end of me. That made me the last labor reporter on television. I should say something about KQED radio, which is a different matter than KQED television. KQED radio is a different matter than KQED television. I don't say that KQED radio covers labor. No, not at all. But what I'm saying is that KQED radio does include my commentaries on labor in their regular perspective series, which is a series of commentaries that they have on a regular basis. So they're at least doing that. And NPR, though, let me tell you just a little bit about NPR. They are a little different. You know, I had read not long ago that NPR was accepting freelance radio commentaries. I said, oh, well, what the hell, I might as well try. I mean, I had a lot of experience in that. After all, I broadcast on KPFA for 20 years as a regular commentator. So I did a lot of radio work. So I wrote them. I read their instructions, which said, to audition, send us a tape with 3 sample commentaries on it, and we'll look at it. So I did. And they were all on labor, of course. And I included a note saying, if the stuff's good enough, then I hope that it'll give you a... I hope you'll want to use it, because it'll give you a chance to cover an area that you don't cover. NPR does not cover labor. And here's a chance. You know. And I didn't get any response. So I waited a while, and I sent them another letter, said, what's happened? And no response there. So I gave it up. And so then one morning I was listening to KQED radio, to the great program, I hope some of you have heard it, the forum program with Michael Krasny. And Michael had on there a guy who was billed as the NPR ombudsman. And he was a hotshot who had been in commercial broadcasting for a long time, and who was hired to represent the listeners in trying to get NPR to change their programming to reflect more what the listeners wanted. And so Krasny said to him, well, what do you think should be done? He said, well, the first thing that should be done is we should cover more labor. We don't cover labor at all. And boy, bingo, you know. So I immediately wrote a note to him and told him what had happened, that they had not responded to me, and said, how about you interceding on my behalf? That's what you're supposed to do as an ombudsman, and try to get them to listen, at least listen to my tapes. Maybe they're not any good, I don't know, but at least give me a shot. And he got back to me with a note saying, well, it'll take a while to get them to agree to labor. That's a real tough thing. But hang on and don't give up. And that was about 5 months ago. I'm still hanging on, but I have given up, you know. So what I'm saying is that there's no more chance for PBS or NPR to cover labor. I'm afraid there isn't. PBS, of course, seems to be looking for different kinds of viewers. They say that, I've talked to the people, and they say, well, labor isn't popular anymore. I mean, only 15% of people belong to unions. You know, don't forget it. Well, the problem is they're not supposed to be appealing to popularity. They're supposed to be presenting what's important. And it may be elitist, but they're supposed to be, that's what they have these people for, you know, to decide what's important and present it to us. But instead of that, they say, well, it's not popular, so we're not going to present it. So, in any case, that's my, I don't know how sad it is, but sad to me, story. So, thanks for listening.
Thanks, Dick. There has been coverage nationally of labor and on Pacifica, and I think one of the best stations to listen to, or one of the best radio programs to listen to, is Counterspin. And we have with us tonight Janine Jackson from New York, and she has been covering, as well as the rest of the producers at Counterspin, some of the stories about labor and the struggle against censorship and the struggle to get labor's voice out. So welcome, Janine Jackson.
I'm proud to say I also host a cable access show in New York called Labor at the Crossroads. We're talking this week about the NAB, the National Association of Broadcasters, and one of the things that I've been pointing out that we've been talking about is that they have always promoted, the NAB has since its beginnings promoted this model of broadcasting that we have today, this commercial advertiser-driven model, and they've thwarted alternatives. Now, labor groups and working people lose out in this corporate system, in this model of broadcasting, in a couple of ways that I want to talk about. First of all, you know, this system where media companies are giant corporations and where the revenue that fuels the system comes from other giant corporations who are advertisers. That's the system. This is bad for labor and for working people across the board for a couple of reasons. First of all, very simply, corporate media owners are part of corporate America, and they just don't have an interest, a bottom line interest, in telling, as Dick was explaining, in telling stories about labor and about labor's battles and struggles for fair wages and working conditions and so on. In fact, media companies are themselves some of the most anti-labor companies around. So, for example, you can have the Washington Post, which has an editorial that says, you know, it's not so bad using replacement workers. We've used them ourselves, you know. It worked out great for us, you know. In fact, a Washington Post reporter named Peter Pearl some years ago decided to do an undercover investigation on these union-busting companies, and he went sort of undercover to a meeting of one of these organizations. And as he's in this room, he's looking around and seeing one boss of his from the Washington Post and another boss and another boss. These are his bosses taking lessons, you know. And in fact, he talked to one of the heads of this company and he said, oh yes, the Washington Post is a leader in this field. And then you can also have something like the Detroit Free Press, who editorialized for the ban on replacement workers, but then when their workers went on strike, they immediately went and brought in scabs right away. So don't believe everything you read, I guess, is the lesson there. So that's the first way. Corporate media are corporations. It's just not in their interest to consistently tell stories that substantively undermine their worldview. But then there's another way that this system works badly for labor and for working people, and that's the fact that it's an advertiser-driven system. And this is something that it's hard to remember. It's hard to keep in mind. We hear about the media market, you know, and I think we forget that in this market, we, the audience, are not the client. There is a market of some sort, but the client is the advertiser. We're the product, you know. We're what's being sold. Our attention, our eyeballs, as they call them. And if you read these trade magazines or some of the NAB literature, it's very crude. It's very straight up, you know. Pictures of people tied up and in boxes saying, we deliver Hispanics to you, you know, or something like this, you know. We're the product. Now, what that means is that it really isn't the public that's ultimately determining what gets on the air. It's the ones who sign the checks, and those are the sponsors. And if you don't think people are very aware of their corporate owners, you know, in the news division, maybe they don't even know who their corporate parent is. Well, just think that when Disney had 101 Dalmatians out in the theaters, Peter Jennings of ABC News, his paycheck had spots on it, you know, just like everybody else within the company. So it's the sponsor that's determining what kind of programming we're going to get. And sponsors don't want just any old audience. They don't want to have their ads on shows that reach the widest variety of people. They want particular audiences, and they pay a premium for those audience. What kind of audience? Well, wealthier, higher end, you know, high income. And also, and here's a dirty little secret that's a very open secret, white, you know. They have particular kinds of audiences they want. They pay more for programs that reach those audiences. They pay less for programs that don't. That's the structure of the system. And so they're not really interested in shows about working people's struggles. That's not really reaching the clients that they want to reach. And news is also skewed in this way, as I'm sure you know. So we can have stories like, you know, a cover story on a magazine that says, everyone's getting rich, you know. And you think to yourself, well, I'm not getting rich. Nobody I actually know is getting rich, you know. And yet here this is a National News Weekly saying, this is the story of the day, how everyone's rich nowadays, you know. Well, you know, they're reaching out for the people who they think are going to jibe with that. You know, and Newsweek had a story about, you know, the kind of guilt that you feel when all of a sudden you're richer than your friends. And, you know, how do you talk to them? And it's really kind of, you know, there's a lot of angst there, evidently. I don't know. And you can have straight up anti-union coverage. And this is, I mean, you really can't say this boldly enough. I mean, there aren't too many constituencies left that people can talk about this way, where Time Magazine can say, can begin a story. This was a story about Ron Carey several years ago. Time Magazine begins a story saying, images of union leaders as spaghetti-sucking mob bosses may be harsh. They may also be true. You know, and you love the, like, bit of ambiguity in there, you know. I'm sure that that reporter would say, I did not say union leaders were spaghetti-sucking mob bosses, you know. I'm just saying one could say that, you know. Or you can have, and I remember this quote, just it's in my brain, you can have USA Today begin a story. Analysts say the Lordstown strike will determine whether GM can stick to its gut-wrenching plan to become a lean industrial powerhouse or give in once again to the United Auto Workers Union. Well, you know, which side are you supposed to be on in that conversation? But I love how analysts say, you know, it's not, again, it's not USA Today, it's some unnamed analyst who can be brought in to make that point. And then you also have, and I think Dick told this very vividly, you also have the large-scale abandonment of the labor beat, which used to be, you know, I don't think stories of the halcyon days of media when everyone had a voice, I don't think those days existed, but we did used to have a labor beat as a regular feature in many papers. And this is crucial. It was understood that it was different than the business beat, you know? It was understood that labor and that economics is a contested field, that economics is a political field where some people have some interests and they oppose the interests of other groups in society. We don't have that economic coverage nowadays. We have economic news that really, I mean, they might as well say what's good for GM is good for the country. You know, it's implicit in every story that the rising tide is lifting all boats. And that we're not talking about something where a gain for management may not be a gain for the workers. It's just, it's all one. We're all just one happy family. And after all, since now people have some bonds maybe, or maybe a little bit in the stock market. Now really, you know, really now Wall Street's interests really are your interests. So that's there. And then, you know, the labor beat disappearing, that was actually one of the sort of many casualties of the Detroit strike, which not everyone noticed. I mean, we remember all the horrible coverage and the treatment of workers and Robert Giles, the Detroit News editor, writing a column in which he said that management was carrying out the legacy of Martin Luther King Jr., you know, because they were standing up to the established order. Okay. But one of the is deep, yeah. But one of the casualties of that strike was the labor beat. The Detroit Free Press had a labor reporter. He went out on strike with the strikers, and they just never replaced him. Whoops, you know. That beat's disappeared. And we're talking about Detroit. Okay. So straight up anti-union coverage that fits in with that. Now, this, of course, extends, as Dick also mentioned, to PBS, to public broadcasting as well, which is supposed to be the alternative. I'm talking about commercial media. This is the commercial media system that's driven by advertisers, and that's why it's skewed in this particular way. You wouldn't think that would be the case with public broadcasting, but unfortunately it is. In fact, activists, including FAIR activists, have regularly been told over the years that PBS would love to have a show about labor. It's just they can't find a corporation that wants to sponsor it. You know. So we have four or five on our public alternative media. We have, depending on your market, we have four or five or more shows about picking stocks and investing. As if that really was what we were all up to, you know. I mean, in case, you know, I know we know in this room the vast majority of people make their living from wages, okay.
What about the PBS guidelines?
Well, exactly. That's, thank you, Henry, you know. So, you know, that's the lay of the land. So the next step might be, well, why don't unions fund a show? That was just what I was getting to. Why don't unions fund a show? Unions have money. Some of them do. Why don't they fund their own show? Well, because PBS has these guidelines that say that the producers of a show can't have too close an interest in the content of the show that they're producing. And these guidelines are interpreted in really, it would twist your brain in a knot to try to follow them the way this works. The way it's played out, well, for example, the documentary Out at Work, which was a documentary that talked about workplace discrimination against gays and lesbians. This was an award-winning documentary that PBS refused to distribute. And when you read, as I've read the letter, to the producers explaining why they couldn't distribute it, they said, we have guidelines that prohibit even the appearance of a conflict of interest between the producers and the content of a show. And we know that, and that you got, you know, a $5,000 check from the UAW here, and you got, you know, a couple thousand dollars from another union over here. And even though we know that this didn't influence the content of your show, and by the way, the documentary is wonderful, we love it, but these strict guidelines that we have, our hands are tied, we just can't distribute it. They also said that one of the other problematic funders was a group called Estrella, which is a national lesbian rights organization, which I presume might be seen as biasing the producers in favor of human rights. The thing to know is that PBS, these guidelines are very slippery and bendy and stretchy, such that even in this case where unions had, no one union had given the majority of the funding to Out at Work. In fact, the producers had paid it, most of it, out of their own pocket. And the program was not about any one union in particular. It was about an issue. It could not be read as an advertisement for any union by a long shot. But that was, you know, they have these guidelines, and it's not really real conflict of interest. It's just the appearance of a conflict of interest. Nevertheless, that same network, and I could give many examples, but my favorite is that they aired a documentary called James Reston, The Man Millions Read, that was about a New York Times columnist. And it was directed by a woman who is a Salzburger, a member of the family that owns the Times. And gee, it was produced by the New York Times. And I actually had the opportunity to have a sort of debate with a representative of PBS about this, just this issue. She talked about Out at Work, and I said, well, what about James Rest and the Man Millions Read? And suddenly things were different. And it wasn't the appearance of a conflict of interest. She said, but the New York Times didn't fund that. I said, yes, they did, actually, you know, because, see, we looked into it, and they actually did provide the funding. Well, but they worked with, they produced it in collaboration with a TV station in Virginia, and we didn't really feel that, you know, the New York Times held editorial control. Said, well, do you feel that the UAW held editorial control of Out at Work? You know, the point being, they didn't even ask the question with regard to Out at Work. And then when I said, well, that doesn't sound right to me, and everyone in the room groaned, you know, audibly, she said, well, but it's also something else. It's that the New York Times is a journalistic institution, and so we felt they could be expected to handle it fairly and to not have a, you know, blah, 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 blah. The point is, a double standard is no standard at all. And in fact, when pressed on the matter by formerly Village Voice reporter Jim Ledbetter, asking a PBS representative, does this mean that in effect no union can ever fund a show that will air on PBS? He said yes. He said, yeah, that's what it means. And yet corporations can regularly, on a weekly, daily basis, sponsor shows that are about their own interests. So that's, you know, even where we would look to for the change, it's not there for the alternative. So I guess my point is, corporations are never going to want to sponsor shows about poor people, about working class people, about unions, or really about anything that they believe. That's nice. Am I getting a... They're trying to shut us down, you know. They're never going to want to produce or sponsor programs that really substantively undermine their worldview. And so the point is that these problems are structural. It's not that reporters are evil. It's not that reporters are stupid, although heaven knows some are. It's not that they're bad, and it's not, and this is, I really want to emphasize, it's not that labor isn't savvy enough, you know. It's not that unions aren't clever enough about how to get their issues covered. Although many people, I feel, still believe that if we could just do it right, if we could just tell the story in a snappy enough way, maybe they'd give us better coverage. The problems are structural. It has to do with who owns the outlets and how those outlets are fueled, how they're funded. The problems are structural, but the structure is not inevitable. And that's what this week is about. It has not always been this way in this country, and it does not need to always be this way. What we have to do and what we're trying to do this week is to refocus the whole discussion around media, refocus that whole debate so that the public interest is at the center of it and not an afterthought, not a byproduct, hopefully, perhaps. We have to stop asking whether the system is working for the media companies that run it and start asking whether it's working for people. So that's what we're here about this week, and I'm happy to see so many of you. Thanks.
Well, now, there are a couple things I wanted to talk about. First of all, in 1989, there were a group of community access producers, labor, radio, and TV people who got together to start to work together and network on this issue of censorship of labor and having independent labor programming. And we formed an organization called the Union Producers and Programmers Network, UPNET. And we are an independent group. We have people who are supported by their union and independent labor producers and radio and TV, but we believe that there has to be an organized political campaign to make this an issue and to fight for labor representation and labor programming. And we have a newsletter, and everybody can pick up a copy. It's called UPNET News, and it gives an example of a producer in Rockford, Illinois, who wanted to have a labor show on the community access station. And what they actually did, and this is illuminating to how they control it, even in community access, they said, sure, we want to have shows. Well, he brought his show in, And they said after a couple of shows, well, we can't have this show. And he said, why not? It's too controversial. And somebody had made the mistake of actually writing down comments about it talks about a march of workers at Tiger, bad songs about the unions, bad things about the bosses. And he listed National March in Detroit, scabs, anti-scab signs, wanted posters for business leaders. This is in the video. And it was on the basis of this that they rejected that show on community access, which, of course, is illegal. But we were able to take on that fight, and they were able to get the show on the air. But this is a constant battle, and we believe that the labor movement should use its power and muscles in this country and its apparatus to have 500 to have 1,000 labor shows around the country. We should be using community access to have labor shows throughout the United States, and also the unions should have a national labor cable channel broadcast 24 hours a day. That's possible. In my own view, instead of giving $40 million or $45 million to Gore and the Democrats, set up your own labor media. We are also working to have a labor program, UpNet, a half-hour program on the Dish Network on Free Speech TV. And we want to encourage labor producers around the country, radio and TV, to start submitting their stuff nationally so we can get this out. We believe also that the labor movement, the unions, and we had a resolution which we presented to the AFL-CIO convention, should demand that there be public hearings, congressional hearings, on the censorship and monopolization of the media as a threat to democracy. That this is a threat to all working people, to the entire public, the monopolization of the media. We have to say we cannot tolerate a dictatorship of these monopoly media corporations. They're destroying the rights of people in this country. And labor has to take that up. We have a vested interest in taking that up because of the fact that issues like, how many people know about the ARMCO, aka steel strike? Nobody. I mean, you had a situation in Detroit during the Detroit newspaper workers strike that they actually tried to buy ads, radio ads, to publicize the strike on radio stations in Detroit, and they were told, no, we're not going to sell you the ads. The radio station said that. Now, I believe, as does UpNet, that when there's a censorship, we should do a national campaign. Take away your goddamn license. If you won't give the labor unions rights, take away your license. One of the ways we can organize for labor, I believe, using the internet, is maybe we should have one day a month of labor solidarity, where you target one company, your 800 number, and you talk to them. Why are you violating labor law? You pound their phones. And you shut down their ability to get orders for rooms. That would change the attitude of the Marriott Corporation. That requires organizing all of us in labor, getting all the email addresses of all workers so that they can get this information. If we can do that, we will be able to build a strong movement, and we will be able to take on these multinationals. I mean, I do know that there was a struggle against the Mitsubishi Corporation, and this was, I think, 5 or 6 years ago. They were going to develop some forest, tear down some forest, develop some forest, tear down some forest in the Philippines. And there was an international campaign against Mitsubishi International. They blockaded all of Mitsubishi's international operations, their telephones, their faxes, their phone numbers. For 3 days, Mitsubishi decided to cancel their project in the Philippines. If you shut the communication apparatus down of these companies, you can have power to have effect. And we can do that in labor if we really try.
You've been listening to a forum on labor and media recorded September 22nd in San Francisco as part of the counter convention and protest at the NAB's annual radio convention.